You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Georgina Godwin, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck College here in London. Oscar, what do you have for us?
The prize mechanism is under attack in Britain, while Cuba seems ready to embrace it. Is this orthodoxy or heresy? Plus, Europe joins Latin America against US global surveillance.
We'll hear more from Oscar later, also ahead.
You know all those security scenarios we ran? I'm smack in the middle of one we didn't think of.
Can anybody hear me?
We'll be meeting the film critic who has boiled down almost a century of movie history into a collection of rather beautiful and entertaining infographics.
Also, before the end of the show, we'll hear from Bonifacio Global City, the newest urban center in the Philippines, on how it might offer a template for city planners around the world.
It's more organized, it's more planned, which is the exact opposite of the rest of Metro Manila. It's probably the Manila that we wish we had.
All that plus we'll play some music as well. So that's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has urged President Obama to end drone strikes in Pakistan, touching on a sore subject just as relations improve after years of suspicion over Afghanistan and the US counterterrorism fight. The two men held talks in the Oval Office at the White House on Wednesday. Acknowledging that there had been tensions and misunderstandings between the two countries, Mr. Obama said their talks covered security, senseless violence, terrorism, and extremism.
We agreed that we need to continue to find constructive ways to partner together, ways that respect Pakistan's sovereignty, that respect the concerns of both countries. And I'm optimistic that we can continue to make important strides in moving forward because both the Pakistani people and the American people have suffered terribly from terrorism in the past.
There have been fresh claims about the extent of surveillance carried out by the US National Security Agency, this time in Germany. Chancellor Angela Merkel has spoken to President Obama after receiving information that her mobile phone was monitored. But White House spokesman Jay Carney said the president had told her the US wasn't snooping on her communications.
The US is reviewing the way that we gather intelligence to ensure that we properly balance the security concerns of our citizens and allies with the privacy concerns that all people share. Both leaders agreed to intensify further the cooperation between our intelligence services with the goal of protecting the security of both countries and of our partners, as well as protecting the privacy of our citizens.
An explosion near Damascus Airport has triggered power cuts across much of Syria. It's reported that rebel artillery hit a gas pipeline which supplies a power station. Residents of the capital say the whole city has lost power. Syria's electricity minister says it could take up to 48 hours to restore supplies. It's been revealed that the bushfires, which destroyed more than 200 homes in the Blue Mountains area of New South Wales, were started by an Australian Army exercise. Although residents were able to return home on Wednesday, as firefighters succeeded in preventing the fires from spreading, the crisis is far from over, with more than 50 blazes still burning. An investigation has found that the biggest fire was started when an explosion ignited bushland during an army training exercise. Mark Greenhill is the Blue Mountains mayor.
I'm certainly not out for a witch hunt, and I'm certainly not out to, you know, sort of demand retribution. I think on behalf of my community, what we need is knowledge so that I can say to them we've learned lessons that will prevent this from happening again.
A 13-year-old California boy carrying a replica of an assault rifle has been shot and killed by sheriff's deputies who apparently believed the gun was real. The incident took place in the Northern California community of Santa Rosa on Tuesday, a day after a 12-year-old boy killed a teacher at a Nevada school with a gun he also used to take his own life. Although authorities declined to identify the child killed in the California incident, his father, Rodrigo Lopez, said he was 13-year-old Andy Lopez. He was on his way to a friend's house with a pellet gun left at the family home over the weekend. A World War II era P-51 Mustang plane owned by a Texas museum crashed into Galveston Bay on Wednesday, killing the two people on board. The cause of the accident hasn't been determined, but the Federal Aviation Administration says the pilot wasn't in contact with air traffic control just before the crash happened. The plane was manufactured in 1944, according to FAA records, and owned by the Texas Aviation Hall of Fame, part of the Lone Star Flight Museum in Galveston. Police said 51-year-old Keith Hibbert from Denton, Texas, was flying the plane. British citizen John Busby, who was 66, was his passenger. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. It is 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Well, it's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three stories that we'll be keeping our eyes on throughout the day here on Monocle 24. I'm delighted to say that joining us today is Oscar Guardiola Rivera of Birkbeck College here in London, also a renowned author. Just remind us of the title of your book, Oscar.
The Story of a Death Foretold, the coup against Salvador Allende, 11 September 1973, 40 years ago.
That is not a story, in fact, we're looking at today, because we're actually starting closer off to home, something that's happening all over the world, but certainly here in Britain, we're seeing massive price rises in the cost of fuel.
Yes, although there is a relationship. It has to do with the dogma of the price mechanism. But yes, it seems the price mechanism is under attack in Britain. British citizens are facing a perfect storm of price rises, wage freezes and benefit curbs. Rising energy bills in the UK, it has been said, could be the final nail in the financial coffin for many Britons who are already struggling to meet the cost of living.
And this is after we've seen the energy companies announce price rises of something like 10% over the previous year. Earlier this week, we heard of a big deal between the French energy company EDF and the British government saying they're going to build a new nuclear plant, and lots of criticism being waged against the British saying, you know, the price that they've set for that nuclear plant when the energy is going to come out is double what the wholesale price it is today. So lots of criticism, a perfect storm in a sense.
Absolutely. In fact, the chorus of critics was joined recently by none other than the Conservative former Prime Minister John Major, who called on the current government for living a tax, a sort of windfall tax against these, what he called excess profits.
And of course, this was taken up during Prime Minister's Question Time yesterday in Parliament here in Britain, where David Cameron agreed with Major. He also caused a storm by calling Ed Miliband a con man.
Yes, but it has to be said, Miliband's first question was a pretty lethal one. Cameron has said that anyone who wanted to intervene in the market price mechanism was living in a Marxist universe. And Miliband retorted by asking, could he say how he felt now that the Red Peril had claimed Sir John Major?
Because, of course, Ed Miliband saying that he would freeze energy prices if he was brought into government. Well, let's look at how this is all playing when it comes to the country's climate change policy.
That's true. While the pros and cons of both positions are being debated, the government is putting the blame on an imperfect market, but also on the green taxes which were created while Ed Miliband was energy secretary. However, it has to be said that the Climate Change Act, which is the target of the Prime Minister's criticism, was approved nearly unanimously back in 2008. So many have pointed out that this might be a sort of U-turn on the part of a government who proposed back in 2008 to British voters to vote blue, to go green.
And do you think that this is likely to put strain on the coalition?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, we have already seen those the signs. The leaders of the Lib Dem party have been very clear on the firm position to keep these climate change policies on track.
Oscar, let's move on to another story which you've highlighted for us. Cuba scrapping its two-tier currency. Quite a surprising move, but part of broader reforms, I guess.
It's part of a broader reform. It's yet another step on the financial reform that is taking place in Cuba, pretty much unreported in the media, unfortunately. The government said it had approved a plan to gradually eliminate the dual monetary system that had been in place for the last two decades. It was said that unification is imperative to guarantee the re-establishment of the Cuban peso's value and its role as money, that is, as a unit of accounting, which is very interesting because if you read between the lines, this is a reference to an early critic of imposing a Soviet-style economic model on the island, none other than Ernesto Che Guevara, who in 1965 was already very critical of imposing that sort of model in the Caribbean island.
Now, they talk about a gradual process, but what sort of time span are we looking at?
There was no a specific time span, but if we are to judge this on the precedent of previous reforms, this will be quite quick. In fact, an economist at Havana University's Center for Cuban Economic Studies pointed out that this should be done quickly because it will eliminate the crazy situation today where a company is profitable in dollars and runs at a loss in pesos.
So how is this actually going to work in practice? So, of course, Cuba, one of its largest money earners, of course, is the tourism industry. And tourists, when they come to the country, use the peso, which is pegged to the U.S. dollar. But that is slowly going to be gradually, as you mentioned, brought out. So how is it actually going to work in practice? And what impact could this potentially have on this huge tourism industry?
Well, the idea is that you're going to see a unification of the two monetary currencies, the convertible peso and the local peso. In principle, and this adds to your previous question, the gradual mechanism will be rolled out during 18 months. And the idea is that by then, those who act in the tourist industry will be able to use the former, the convertible peso, which is pegged to the US dollar.
And what about workers' wages? Is it likely to impact on that?
It is indeed, because part of the unfairness of the current mechanism is that it means normal workers are left with a less valuable currency than anybody else, and particularly those who are agents in the tourism industry. So now we're going to see a raise in the real income standards.
Right. Let's move on now to your next story, and this is all about eavesdropping. Would you care if anyone listened to your mobile phone conversations, Oscar?
Well, I care because they will be terribly bored.
But not the same can be said possibly about Angela Merkel, who's very cross because it appears that the Americans have been doing just that.
Absolutely. And if we have been following this story for quite a while already. So now, not only Germany, but also France add their voices to the chorus of protestations, which began in Brazil and also Mexico. And it seems to be exactly the same pattern. With the Americans first kind of denying that they have been listening, but revelations coming from possibly from Edward Snowden's leaks confirming that in fact they were snooping on in this case Chancellor Merkel's own telephone, same as with Dilma Rousseff. So of course the U.S. is government is being obliged to come up with some serious explanations.
What I find fascinating is the language that the White House is using. So Jay Carney, the spokesman for the White House, the president, came out yesterday during a press conference saying the United States is not monitoring and will not monitor communications of the chancellor. But many people saying they didn't say that they weren't. So
absolutely
perhaps they
case.
Were.
Absolutely the case. The language he chose leaves open the question whether they were listening in the past. And that's precisely the problem. In addition to that, it seems to be the case that most of this snooping has nothing to do with security issues, but rather with gathering economic data. which is quite complicated.
Now, the Dilma Rousseff dinner was in fact meant to take place last night at the White House. Do you think that this Merkel incident will affect diplomatic relations there in Germany, as it did with Rousseff?
Well, it was announced today that there will be a EU summit, and surely this theme will lead the agenda. Of course, in principle, we see caution. But as I said, the U.S. has some serious explaining to do.
And Oscar, let's move on to another story, which, of course, has been in the headlines recently. Greenpeace and charges by the Russian government that they were pirates at sea.
And Russia has announced that it will drop these piracy charges. Instead, the Arctic 30 will be charged with hooliganism, which is, carries a much lesser sentence. This demonstrates that, international pressure did have an effect on the Russian government.
Putin said that it was completely obvious that they weren't pirates. So why go ahead with it?
Well, he's saying that now, but clearly, previously, they were trying to clamp down on these protesters. I mean, these protesters came from 18 different countries. It included six Britons. Investigators had gone as far as saying that they had found drugs in. So clearly, this was the idea to just clamp down on these protesters as hard as possible, but the strategy has backfired.
Excellent stuff, Oscar. Many thanks for joining us here on the program. As always, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, author of "Story of a Death Foretold." Thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually. And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And the guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he'd used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And welcome back to the program with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgie Godwin. It's 9:19 in Brussels, 8:19 here in London. Now, just before the break, we were hearing from Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Recent claims that the U.S. government was spying on the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Well, it created headlines the White House probably didn't want to have. Well, it can be expected that this will be a top issue at the quarterly EU summit that is taking place today. So will NSA snooping be at the top? Well, joining us now is our woman in Brussels, Charlotte McDonald Gibson. Charlotte, welcome to the program. How much is this issue going to dominate the summit?
Well, yesterday morning, there was talk that perhaps it wouldn't be
such a big deal. President Hollande was a little upset, and he'd said he wanted it to be on the agenda after revelations early this week that up to 70 million French communications had potentially been spied on by the NSA. But other nations were playing it down, saying that there were other important issues on the table. But of course, after the revelations last night that Angela Merkel's phone could have been hacked, I think it's going to top the agenda now. I think that when the leaders start arriving later on this afternoon, there's going to be some strong comments on this issue, and I think the EU leaders are going to have to come together and address this somehow.
Charlotte, the other issue topping the agenda today is about boosting the digital economy in Europe.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that's very much what the focus was meant to be on. It's a long-term plan by the EU. They've got all sorts of measures in place to open up the telecoms market, to increase Wi-Fi and various removal of red tape to create a united digital economy in Europe. So they're very focused on the positive aspects of this conference. But of course, there's other aspects of the digital economy which also play into this NSA spying row, which is data protection. And the European Parliament on Monday passed some quite stringent data protection rules governing the digital economy, and that again was in direct response to these allegations of NSA spying both on the EU institutions and on individual member states. So there's absolutely no doubt it has caused a deep mistrust between the US and some of its key allies.
Well, you mentioned there, Charlotte, that Hollande and Merkel will probably come out to address the issue of the NSA snooping allegations. Do we actually expect there to be real repercussions towards the Americans? Can we expect any real damage to the special relationship?
It's hard to say, because the question is, what exactly can these countries do? I mean, they get an awful lot as well out of their relationship with the states. Being an America's ally is crucial for them on the world stage. So if we look at the measures that have been taken so far, I mentioned that the increase in data protection that they spoke about on Monday. Then yesterday, for example, the European Parliament voted to suspend this bank data sharing agreement that they have with the US aimed at detecting terrorist fundraising, which dates back to post 9/11. So that still would have to have agreement by all 28 heads of state to become effective. But things like that, these sharing agreements could be jeopardized. So that's one thing. And certainly it's the embarrassment as well to the United States to see Germany, their key ally on the world stage, coming out with very, very strong words against their security operations.
Charlotte, many thanks for joining us on the program. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson in Brussels.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, where it's time to immerse ourselves in the world of cinema. Well, ever wonder what the longest movie road trips in film have been? Or perhaps you're interested to know who the best James Bond has been based on the number of kisses he gets? Well, these are just some of the questions film critic Karen Krasanovich looks at in her book, Infographics Guide to the Movies.
Well, as the title might suggest, you won't need to put your reading glasses on, as the book is jam-packed with over 100 brightly coloured and fantastically illustrated infographics, giving you all the movie trivia you could possibly need, plus a little bit more. Like, did you know that according to a panel of female critics that Hugh Jackman, Georgina, from X-Men Last Stand, has the sexiest ears, the most bangable ears? Did you know that?
I honestly can't say that I awfully care.
Well,
not about ears.
Well, but the author of Infographic Guide to the Movies, Karen Krasanovich, joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the program, Karen. It is a fantastic book. Loads of trivia. How did you possibly do the research for this?
I did it all myself.
I mentioned ears.
It just didn't stop the research on this.
There were 31 designers working on this book. And also I worked with people at Essential Press. And it's put out, I think it's put out by Octopus in America. It was the number one book on LA Weekly, I think, a couple weeks ago, beating out this other book that was really good. And I was just like thinking, why did that happen? Oh, yeah, pictures.
Well, it's not just pictures. It's graphs. It's Venn diagrams. It's charts. And you've got over 100 original artworks and illustrations in there too.
We've got some terrific designers on it. Okay, how did we get all the information? Well, what happened is, I pitched a lot of ideas for this book, and because we were working with a team, although it does have my name on it, I am usurping other people's research, I must say.
It's always the best way.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that's how art grows, I understand. I've also had some criticisms that there are some errors in the book, and I'm going, you know, it's made by people and it's put in print and there's an error? You're kidding, right? I would love this book to be online so I could fix all of the little typos, because there are a few. But it was a lot of work, a lot of checking. And of course, it's a snapshot in time because the movie industry, you know, goes on. And so obviously there are things that we could add on. But I'm particularly delighted that the nexus of information trivia that we all love, and also wonderful design. But another thing I think is really useful about this is that infographics have been shown. If you read my sort of very strange intro, I'm looking at that thinking, well, I should have written that better. that infographics are a wonderful learning tool. So if you're going to go to a party with some movie people, look at my book and you'll be ready in about 5 minutes.
It's so entertaining just to spend, you know, a good hour or two with this book. Like, did you know there's a really funny zombie outbreak map? So it tells you where the most dangerous or perhaps where the safest part of the world is to avoid a zombie attack.
Oh, how
so
fantastic.
You don't want to be in California. That's the number one place.
We're looking after you with this book. Yeah. You know, we want to make sure that you're covered.
We also have a clip from one of the Leonardo DiCaprio film Inception. Let's play a clip and then we'll have a chat about it.
A single idea from the human mind can build cities. An idea can transform the world and rewrite all the rules. Which is why I have to steal it.
A clip there from the film Inception, and you have a bit of a diagram here as well for us.
Yes, we like that. That's the kind of diagram you can see from space, which is really, really
I want to see. Wow, that's
it could be
a
little more colorful
diagram. And it's all about following the journeys of the characters in the movie as they move through the four levels of dream time.
That's right. Yes.
But this is just one of, you know, hundreds of great little bits of trivia that you have in this book.
Yeah, so I think a lot of souls were broken making this book, actually. If you look at every single one of the diagrams, somebody has spent a long time, not me, somebody has spent a long time designing it and making sure that the data that we came up with is in a presentable form. So you can sit back and actually have a good time with the book. But another thing I like about the book is it's going to drive people who are sort of completionists and perfectionists absolutely mad, because there are errors in the book. You know, I tried to make sure that there weren't, but some have snuck through. So it's your job to find them.
Well, there is a quiz, actually. Not only finding the errors, but name that movie of the 1990s, and you use the graphics to identify the titles of 10 memorable films, and then you give us the first letter of the film. I must say that I actually can't work out any of them.
That means you have a life. Isn't that nice?
And there's one with B and a dog, and I think I vaguely remember something like that. Okay. Phil?
I want you for my next book. Something with B and a dog. I love her.
Well, Karen, you know, each one of these infographics they're so unique in their own way. So how difficult was it to have, you know, 160-odd pages here, but having all of them completely unique?
Well, we did use 31 designers. I think it was 31 designers. Maybe one or two fell off. But it was, we had too many ideas, really. It sort of reminded me of Mozart in Amadeus, where the king goes, too many notes. We did. We had too many good ideas, and we had to kind of winnow them down. So some designers suggested a few things that they thought they could make more beautiful than what we suggested. We're not designers, okay. And then we commissioned our designs for others. So that's how we did it. It was really a collaboration. As we say, as Mel Brooks said in 2000 Year Old Man, we are all singing, but I have the mouth.
let's hear a clip from Anaconda, and then let's talk about what you've said on that film.
What is this?
Anaconda skin.
It snakes up there this big.
This skin is 3 or 4 years old. Whatever shed it has grown since then.
Snakes don't eat people.
Oh, they don't?
That's it, man. I'm getting the hell back to L.A.
It's always good to be prepared.
Now, they are the ones being watched.
Do you hear that?
And that was, of course, a clip there from the 1997 film Anaconda, which, Karen, you have a little page here all about animal revenge.
Well, it's one of these things, you know, when you're trying to think of a book of infographics, you're thinking, you know, we don't want it all to be serious box office numbers and things. We'd like to throw some animals in there because everybody loves animals. So I've got a page here. If you're following along, it's page 69, where we've got where we started off with Willard in 1971 as the deadly rat. Actually, had a Michael Jackson song attached to that. I think it was called Ben, if I remember correctly. And then we go into Squirm, which is Worms, and Cujo, St. Bernard. And, of course, Anaconda is one of my favorite films because it's just so bad that you have to see it. The snakes are terrible. But you get to see John Voight, and it's very surprising.
So and Jennifer Lopez in it as well.
Like, oh, I forgot. Yeah. That was before she didn't go upstairs. You're right.
There's a question that I have to ask, because I know it's in the book. I can't find the answer myself just at the moment. Which everyday items found in homes are most often used as murder weapons in film?
Wow, am I supposed to know that?
Yeah.
No, I don't know that. I need another coffee to figure that. Now, the thing is, I've been working on this for such a long time that a lot of the information has pushed the other information out.
Sure. Well, that's a piece of information that if you read the book, you will find out about.
I have to read the book again.
Yeah. Can I recommend this very good book by Karen Chris?
Very, you know, I heard she was nice, but I don't know.
And she's very, very talented because actually it's absolutely fabulous. Phil, it's really, the format is very, very easy to read,
Karen,
isn't it?
Did you actually, have you seen every one of these films that's in the book?
Not everyone, because I don't actually watch zombie movies if I can avoid them, and I also don't watch horror. But I believe that this is the beginning of a series.
Excellent.
So they're going to be doing music, and I don't know what's going to be next, dance, haute cuisine, possibly. I don't know what else they're going to be doing, but
fantastic.
I'm very pleased that mine's the first.
We'll have to wait and see. Well, Karen Krasanovich, author of the Infographic Guide to the Movie, thanks very much for joining us here on the program.
And we'll go straight over to Barney Burnham now for the news.
Thanks, Georgina. The Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has urged President Obama to end drone strikes in Pakistan. The two men held talks in the White House on Wednesday. Mr. Obama acknowledged there had been tensions and misunderstandings between the two countries. There have been fresh claims about the extent of surveillance carried out by the US National Security Agency, this time in Germany. Chancellor Merkel has spoken to President Obama after receiving information that her mobile phone was monitored. An explosion near Damascus Airport has triggered power cuts across much of Syria. It's reported that rebel artillery hit a gas pipeline which supplies a power station. It's been revealed that the bushfires, which destroyed more than 200 homes in the Blue Mountains area of New South Wales, were started by an Australian Army exercise. Although residents were able to return home on Wednesday, as firefighters succeeded in preventing the fires from spreading, the crisis is far from over, with more than 50 blazes still burning. A 13-year-old California boy carrying a replica of an assault rifle has been shot and killed by sheriff's deputies who apparently believed the gun was real. He was on his way to a friend's house with a pellet gun left at the family home over the weekend. A World War II-era P-51 Mustang plane owned by a Texas museum crashed into Galveston Bay on Wednesday, killing the two people on board. The pilot was a 51-year-old local man. His passenger was a 66-year-old British citizen. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin.
New cities seem to pop up everywhere these days. They're all over China to accommodate warp speed urbanisation, and South Korea's Songdo is trying to be something more than just a high-tech business district. Even in Azerbaijan, a new lobster-shaped artificial island city is under construction in the Caspian Sea.
But the reality is cities like these never match the developers' dreams. It's hard to get businesses and people to move there, and they're often void of culture and entertainment. But our correspondent Jason Strother recently came across a rare new city success story in the Philippines.
It's called the Bonifacio Global City, and it's been incorporated into Metro Manila. Jason finds out how this new city defied the odds for this week's edition of The Urbanist.
I'm on a bus and headed to the Bonifacio Global City. I've heard it's the place to be in Manila, and just gazing out the window, it does look a lot different from the rest of the city. Traffic here is minimal, buildings are high and spaced out, and there are even some streets lined with palm trees. Very different indeed from the rest of this concrete jungle. I'm meeting up with Carlo Velasco, a journalist with the Filipino magazine and television program Travel Life. He told me to meet him at a shopping plaza called High Street.
We are here at Bonifacio High Street. It's the main shopping destination and the dining destination here at Fort Bonifacio Global City. So it's a mall and a park at the same time. Bonifacio Global City, or the Fort, as most people call it.
Velasco explains that it's called the Fort because up until about 20 years ago, it had been an American and Filipino military base. But since then, it's been redeveloped from the ground up and now is Manila's hotspot for entertainment and business. Ground broke earlier this year for the country's new stock exchange.
Probably the most expensive piece of land in the Philippines.
Do you think this is a good model for new cities, new towns in the Philippines?
Yes. It's more organized, it's more planned, which is the exact opposite of the rest of Metro Manila. It's probably the Manila that we wish we had.
Velasco's not the only person to tell me something like this about the Fort. I've been to other new cities before, like in South Korea where I live, and I've been, well, less than impressed. So I wanted to find out what makes the Bonifacio Global City a success. I posed that question to Arnel Casanova, who heads the Base Conversion and Development Authority, the government enterprise that converted Bonifacio into what it is today.
Well, this is the map of the entire Bonifacio Global City, the central business district.
Casanova is standing in front of a miniaturized diorama of the fort. The whole city, 11 avenues wide by 40 streets high, comes out to about 240 hectares. To break it all down for me, I asked Casanova for his three top pieces of advice on how to successfully make a new city. And like any real estate agent might tell you, his first tip is location.
Because it's just about a kilometer away from the old central business district, which is the Makati Ayala business district. And then you have the workers coming in from the slum areas, which eventually increased their income level. So the city itself triggered an economic activity that is inclusive to everyone. So I think it's important that when you plan a city, you have to know where the people will be coming from. Who's going to work there, who's going to invest there, who's going to look at it as a leisure place as well. And the second is actually the presence of the institution, which makes the city complete. So it's not only a place where people work, but it's a place where people work and live. And so it has all the institutions needed. You have the hospitals, the best hospitals in the Philippines, the best schools, the malls even, the shopping districts, and all these facilities that you need. And then the third is actually the design of the city itself, because we have designed it in relation to how the human beings would interact with the physical space.
What was the inspiration for the design and layout of the city?
The way we look at the Bonifacio Global City, if you look at it at the entire master plan when we first bidded it out in 1995, it actually looks like a dragon. And the Bonifacio Global City, the central business district, is where the heart of the dragon is. So I think there's also a feng shui element, being Asian, you know, an Asian city. So you have a mixed use, commercial, residential, institutional. They are all near each other. So it sustains both the entire facilities of the city. It's beautifully designed, very accessible, walkable even. That's why in every Sunday here, there'll be fun runs, marathons. So I think it's important that if you're an urban planner to understand and very consciously plan the city, knowing that human beings will live in it. It's not only the aesthetic, physical beauty of a building or of a city, but also how the roads are interconnected, how it would make the quality of life better in that area.
Okay, so for Arnel Casanova of the Base Conversion and Development Authority, location, institutions, and design are the three key aspects of making a new city a success. But if you build it, will they actually come? How do you get people to move into a new city? For those answers, I turn to Bonifacio's former mayor, Freddy Tinga. His first bit of advice, start off small. At first, before people started moving here, the fort was known only as a small nightlife spot. But it got a lot of buzz, and that's not the way most other pop-up cities get started.
You know, you hear about all these developments, you know, we're the next big thing and all that.
You fall flat on your face and people are going to say, told you so. So you have to be able to generate noise from something small. And if you're able to do that, I think the next phase is easier.
Often there's a lot of hyperbole that goes into making a pop-up city. In Korea, I've seen plenty of projects proclaimed to be the international hub for business. Former Mayor Tinga says boasting doesn't get you anywhere.
At the end of the day, if you want the people to put in big bucks, which means developers, they have to make sure that they have buyers coming in. The people who are building the residential condominiums, the office spaces, didn't have a hard time convincing potential tenants and buyers about the quality of the location.
Tinga's second pointer, make the new city as business friendly as possible.
In 2008 and 2010, the World Bank cited us as the most business friendly city in the Philippines. You hear a lot about the difficulties of people getting permits in developing countries and all that. That was definitely not the case. This is where you want foreign businesses to locate. And if they get harassed, if they get hassled, and they don't have an easy time getting their businesses set up here, they're just going to up and go, not to move to another city, could be another country. So the third would be, how sustainable is your place, is your city, is your location? And sustainability covers a whole range of different things, whether it be environmental. You know, if you're churning out a pollution-ridden city, then, it's not going to take long for people to jump ship and leave. Sustainability can talk about how you're pricing yourself out of the market as well. I mean, so I know Bonifacio is commanding a premium, but how much of a premium? You know, if you price yourself out of the market, then you're not a sustainable development as well.
So, starting off small, business-friendly policies and long-term sustainability, the three tricks that made the Bonifacio Global City a success, according to Freddy Tinga. The former mayor did have a message for the world's ambitious developers and politicians that are trying to make their own cities from scratch. Always put function before form and make the city for the people and not a vanity project for yourself. For Monocle in Metro Manila's Bonifacio Global City, I'm Jason Strother.
And you can hear that report and many more on urban life around the world on this week's edition of The Urbanist with Monocle editor Andrew Tuck. That premieres later today at 1900 hours here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're in Budapest. Stay tuned.
Monocle's latest collaboration with Comme des Garçons results in a light, energizing and refreshing unisex perfume, titled and inspired by Japanese cedar Sugi. It has top notes of Mediterranean cypress and pepper from Madagascar, a hint of iris from Florence, and cedar from Virginia. With a bottle designed by Monocle's own designers, Scent 3, Sugi, is the long-awaited addition to Monocle's fragrance collection. Available in all five Monocle shops, Dover Street Market in London and Tokyo, and of course, online at monocle.com/shop.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:43 here in London, and it's time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Joining us today from Budapest is Monocle's man there, Adam Labor. Adam, many thanks for joining us here on the program. Where should we begin today?
Well, the main point about today, it's in fact, perhaps it's yesterday, because yesterday was the anniversary of the 1956 uprising against the Soviets. And there was three demonstrations, so you could take your pick of demonstrations or protests or commemorations. And as is often the case, the country itself split three ways, depending which one it went to.
Now, I know that one of the demonstrations was the opposition uniting in a demo against the government. What exactly are they protesting about? They've said that Orban has been undermining democratic structures. What does that mean?
Well, they say that since the government came to power, Prime Minister Viktor Orban's party, Fidesz, won a two-thirds majority in 2010, that the government has over-centralized the government. It has authoritarian tendencies. It's appointed party supporters to formerly independent institutions. It's been involved in a long-running row and argument with the European Union and the IMF. And also Transparency International agrees with them that corruption has gone up since the new government took power. Well, it's not new anymore, since the government took power 3.5 years ago. And Transparency International even talks about state capture by friends of the government. So they say there's quite a lot to protest about.
How is this impacting on the Hungarian economy? Because we are seeing better than expected positive numbers when it comes to the economy.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that the government says that it's pursuing its own unorthodox policies. It's neither really left-wing nor right-wing. Yesterday you heard Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister, strongly criticise the IMF. You know, Hungary has paid back its loan to the IMF. There's not even an IMF office in Budapest anymore. But at the same time, he's also criticising the multinationals. So especially the power companies, and the government's started now a big fight with them to bring down power and energy prices. Yet at the same time, there are flickers of good news. So Hungary has exited the excessive deficit procedure from the European Union, which meant that its state debt was more than 3% of its GDP. It's managed to get out of that. So, you know, the government says that actually our unorthodox policies are working just fine, thank you very much, and we're still getting foreign investment, and, you know, we're going our own way. So it rejects these criticisms.
You mentioned power there, and of course Orban had said that he would nationalise the power companies. Now, that hasn't happened yet, but they're talking about dividend payments being banned.
Yes, there's all sorts of ideas floating around here. And the first thing to bear in mind is that there's an election coming up in April or May next year. And the government's brought down power prices and is bringing down power prices and is buying up some of the kind of the ancillary infrastructure around it, like gas storage units. And there's more wilder ideas floating around, as you say. I mean, there's no doubt that essentially the government wants to, depending whether you use the word nationalize or state control, bring the energy sector under state control, control the prices, and put more money in people's pockets. There's clearly no doubt about that. Now, interestingly enough, of course, Hungary says it's a center-right party ruling it, Fidesz. It's, you know, when Viktor Orban came to Britain, he came to see David Cameron as his friend. He didn't go and see Ed Miliband. But really, no, Ed Miliband was the one, the Labour leader, he should have seen, because their ideas on the energy sector are very similar.
The EU says that it's watching the developments, particularly in the energy sector. They seem to be a little worried.
Yeah, the EU is permanently worried about Hungary. I mean, there's been an ongoing battle with the EU ever since Viktor Orban's government came to power 3.5 years ago. They've had fights about the judiciary and the independence of the judiciary, about the new national media authority and its role and control over the media, and now and about the new constitution that came into force last year. And so the EU is permanently got Hungary on its radar. And, you know, in a more general, in a wider view, one of the interesting things about what the Orban government's doing, whether or not one agrees with what it's doing, is that it's really pushing the limits of what the EU can do to control a member state when that member state is continually pushing against the limits. And the answer is not very much, actually.
And finally, Adam, you have a great story here all about the Franz Liszt Academy of Music reopening.
Yes, the Franz Liszt Music Academy is really a fabulous music venue. It's got the most amazing acoustics. It's on the square of the same name, Liszt-Ferenc Square in Hungarian, which is a beautiful square, tree-lined, surrounded by cafes, one of the great squares of the city. And it's been shut for a while, and it's now been reopened, and everyone's very pleased about that, because it's one of the great venues of Budapest. And there's another concert hall further down the river, which is also very good, but it's modern and it doesn't have quite the same atmosphere as the Liszt-Ferenc Academy. So we're all happy about that.
I understand that the Academy had a great collaboration with the Japanese government, the Aviso Studio, which provides sound recording equipment and training for students. So not all classics then. Are they continuing with that modern approach within the revamped venue?
I think they're going to be aware of their classical heritage, but they're also looking to bring some more modern ideas in as well, because also they want to have more international collaborations. So definitely, I think they're looking to carry on with those kind of collaborations.
Excellent stuff, Adam. We're unfortunately going to have to leave it there. Adam Labor, Monocle's correspondent in the Hungarian capital, Budapest. Thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Well, it's time now for some music. And before we head off to leaf through the Italian newspapers, well, let's get an Italian song. This is Annalisa and her track, Io Tu e Noi.
Questo mondo in cui non sai cosa sei e cosa vuoi. Non mi dire è tutto ok, se poi ti scordi anche di noi. Non guardare sempre giù, non cade solo pioggia da lassù. E se potessi darti gli occhi miei, vedresti un cielo come non l'hai visto mai, mai, mai.
I'm going to ask you to say it, David, because I got it wrong when I introduced it and Phil Harm got very cross with me. It's Io tu e noi.
Yes, you and us. Me, you and us.
Well, and here we are. Me, Georgina Godwin, you, Phil Hahn, and us with David Pleasance, who's here to
review. That didn't really work.
He's here to review the Italian papers. David, thanks very much for coming in this morning.
Thanks,
now, where are we?
Well, I thought we'd look at, first, at La Stampa, Turin's daily. This is focusing on a very sad case of the murder of Gioele Leotta, who was murdered quite near to here in London. In Kent, by non-provoked attack by a group of apparently this article says mainly people coming from Eastern Europe. What's interesting is the tone of this article is really kind of making it clear that the perception within Italy that Great Britain seems to be quite a rough place for economic migrants. Of course, many more Italians are moving here to find work and also to learn the language and so on. So, I mean, it's a kind of a sad piece of advertising for Great Britain.
Well, it's quite interesting because a lot of the Italian press are saying that the victim, he was the victim of a racially motivated attack. And we're getting a sense that the Italian embassy here in London is getting pressure from Rome saying, find out the motivations behind this attack. So obviously the Italian press are kind of framing this as one thing, but I was just looking through some of the British papers and they weren't really framing it as a racially motivated attack at all. So, what's behind those claims?
Yeah, I think this centres on reports and some witnesses apparently say that the attackers were kind of saying derogatory things, expletives against kind of the nationality of the victim. And I think it's a strange case because obviously the attackers themselves don't seem to have been English themselves.
They were Lithuanian, I think. Four Lithuanian men have now actually been charged with it. And so that, again, takes us back to the whole migrant story of these men coming in.
I mean, I think this piece particularly, I mean, it's somewhat strange that the journalist decides to kind of quote "This is England" and various other rather grim depictions of the country. But generally speaking, as the economy in Italy has kind of faltered and more migrants have had to go abroad to seek work, they have been more reports from their new adoptive countries of just how life is and how bleak and often dangerous that might be for some of those migrants.
Absolutely. David, well, let's move on to another story. A 39-year tax feud for Sophia Loren ends.
Yes, that's right. Many people might not know this, although it's fairly well known in Italy, that Sophia Loren actually spent some time in jail in the early 80s. In 1982, she spent 17 days in jail for tax evasion. She actually kind of let herself be arrested. She handed herself in at Rome's Fiumicino airport on return from Switzerland, where she was actually based. But all these years after, 31 years later, the court, the highest court in Italy, the Court of Cassation, has declared that she should not, in fact, have been arrested and have revoked her sentence.
Oh, well, that's fantastic, isn't it? She didn't spend very long in prison, though, did she?
Well, 17 days is quite a long time. And especially, I mean, what's quite interesting, and this paper, the La Repubblica, points out, just last week, the president of Italy has called for an amnesty on many thousands of Italy's prisoners due to overcrowding. And right now, there's not a chance in hell that somebody would have spent any time in prison at all for the similar allegations. So it's just kind of a reflection on how the whole system has changed.
Why did it take 39 years for this feud to finally come to an end? What took so long?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a mystery, really. You'd think if you felt that justice hadn't been done in any way, you might have pushed it a little bit, pushed it on a little bit quicker. There's no reason, I can't seem to find any particular reason why it has been quite so slow, although, as many people might know, that the legal system in Italy is pretty slow. But 31 years is something of a record. 39 years is something of a record.
Well, David, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Many thanks for joining us here on the programme.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks very much to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Andrea Alacon, as well as our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news, it's Culture with Rob Bound. I'll be here at 10 with The Continental Shift. Stay tuned for the briefing at 12 London time. That's 7 a.m. in New York.
I'll be back with Marcus Hippie for tomorrow's edition of Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, George. Gina Godwin, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.